Side 5, Tool of the Trade, by Joe Haldeman, continuing on page 202. No, take me back to the metro. He had to go 3 times as far to return because of one-way streets and signs forbidding left turns. When he pulled up to the taxi stand, I thrust a handful of rubles at him and tried to get out, but the door wouldn't open. He came around and opened the door and helped me out. Then he put his hand on my neck and carefully pushed the rubles deep into my coat pocket. It was a very short drive. How are you living? In Russian, that's a stock hello phrase, but it can be more. I'm living well. I managed to respond and patted him on the shoulder before fleeing downstairs. On the subway, the people politely did not stare at my tears. It was not the unusual sight it would have been in America. We Russians are an emotional people. Perhaps I should not say we. When I got back to the Leningrad, I tiptoed by Valerie and tried to take a nap, but woke up after an hour drenched in sweat, an unspeakably bloody nightmare fading away. Surprisingly, it was not about Alex or my old home. It was something about an arm. A bloody, disembodied arm. Chapter 30. Jacob. Jefferson and I were making a career out of chasing false Foley leads. Most of them cleared up with a few phone calls, though we did take trips on government expense to Cincinnati, Akron, Lincoln, and fabulous Gary, Indiana. No leads would ever show up in New Orleans or San Francisco, or any place else fun. We were sitting in the Cambridge office, I picking my way through a Soviet journal of behavioral psychology, Jefferson poring over a lurid magazine called Full Auto, which was not about cars. It taught you how to use machine guns in various social situations. The phone rang. It was Langley, Harriet Luzner of the Foreign Resources Division. Jacob, she said, I have a man you're just dying to meet. I sat up electrified. You've got Foley? Not actually. Someone almost as good. Why don't you come down and talk to him? Who is it? Let me be mysterious. I want to see your reaction. She could be infuriating. Call when you get manifested, and we'll have a car waiting for you. I hung up. Let's hit the road, Jefferson. The wild goose calls. He unfolded from his nearly horizontal reading position and loped to the closet. He pulled out our 2 overnight bags, nowadays always packed and ready, and his heavy artillery and Kevlar vest. He always dressed informally around the office, just the .44 Magnum and whatever he had tucked away under his clothing. Probably enough to take out a platoon of Viet Cong. I didn't want to know. We had it pretty well figured out by the time we got to Luzner's office, but seeing the bastard in the flesh was a shock, nevertheless. Mikhail Shilkov, a.k.a. the Scalpel. We didn't offer to shake hands, just stared. He looked like Peter Lorre with Charles Manson's eyes. Jefferson said his name. He was sitting in a straight-backed chair with 2 men flanking him, Luzner sitting behind her large, clean desk. You may know Herb Stratton from the FBI, she said. I nodded at him. We'd talked on the phone a few times. And this is Andrew Coleman, also from the FBI. His function is similar to Sergeant Jefferson's. He was not quite as big as Jefferson, but equally well padded. Stratton spoke up. He walked right into Washington headquarters and surrendered. He wanted to make a deal. Come on. Jefferson put my thoughts into words. We don't make deals with this kind of scum, do we? Coleman smiled at that. It was their line of work this guy was debasing. But Stratton scowled. For some things, we'll deal with the devil himself. Shilkoff said 2 magic words. Nicholas Foley. Shilkoff said, I can tell you where to find him. I'd rather let him go, I said to Luzner. Harriet, this guy is... We know what he is. There's a lot at stake. I looked at Shilkoff. What kind of deal do you want? Plea bargaining for torture and mass murder, mutilation? I did not really do that, he said in a rasping voice. Not under my own volition. Foley ordered me to do it. My own comrade. He shook his head in a pretty good simulation of controlled grief. Besides, can you think that I am that stupid? Killing 4 KGB agents, 2 of them in cold blood? We don't think you're stupid, Jefferson said in his best dangerous black person accent. We think you're crazy as a bedbug. He continued in flowery Russian. Compared to your inhumanly cold-blooded evil, even a Rasputin would look like a simple-minded Stilyagi. Don't insult us by playing the innocent. I don't speak Russian, Harriet said coldly. Just amplifying my sentiments, Jefferson said, still staring at Shilkov. Shilkov stared back. I will not talk with this black man in the room. Suits me. He reached inside his jacket, and I tensed. He took out a miniature tape recorder and set it on Harriet's desk. Speak clearly, comrade. He turned and stomped out, remembering to open the door. You can go, too, Harriet said to Coleman. He's very dangerous, ma'am, Coleman said. This room is dangerous. Don't worry. He left. He asked for you specifically, Stratton said. He knew from someone that you were the person who'd been involved with Foley the longest. Your Roberta Bender is a double agent, Shilkov said. I give you that for free. I have much more to give you. Tell me something I don't already know. She's flown the coop. You must be out of touch with your own people. Yes, since the day of the unpleasantness. There was an empty chair a couple of paces away. I dropped into it. Unpleasantness. Sometimes this business makes me sick. He wants to trade, Stratton said. He cited the witness protection program. So he spills his guts and we give him a new identity, I said. Relocate him in some small town somewhere. Exactly, Stratton said. Shilkov's English, his American English, probably wasn't good enough to catch the grace note in that one word. The inflection that implied exactly not, but it reassured me. Okay, sounds like a fair trade, if he does know more about Foley than we do. I know a great deal more. I saw him at the factory in Cabin John. He doesn't look at all like his pictures. I can identify him for you. I may be the only person living who can. Back up, Stratton said. Weren't you here to find him? Yes. Find him and kill him. But you let him go, I said. This is where the story gets fantastic, he said. But I swear that it is true. You may verify this with a polygraph. It was his strange power, but he used it at second hand. I overheard him, by listening device, telling another person that he was not Foley, but rather a private detective in Foley's hire. And I believed it without question. I even captured him and interrogated him as if he were this detective. But not for long, of course. He started giving me orders, and I had to obey. He held up his left wrist, showing an ugly ridge of keloid tissue. He made me do this, try to kill myself, after I'd taken care of the others. He sat up squarely. Your black man accused me of being evil. I have done some extreme things in service to my country, but nothing like Foley. Foley is a madman. Maybe it takes one to know one. All right, I said. But what we're really interested in is exactly where Foley is and how we can safely approach him. Can you tell us those two things? He swung those eyes on me. I think I can tell you where he is, how to approach him safely. I would have an expert sniper shoot him dead from no closer than 100 meters, and have another sniper covering the first. So where do we find him? Stratton said. I will tell you once I am convinced that your witness protection program will hide me from my own people. Not until. Harriet picked up the phone and punched 4 numbers. Eric, it's me. Have you cleared that FBI package? Pause. Okay, bring it on up. She looked at Shilkoff. This will give you a start, but you have to cooperate. You have to keep a low profile. You start tearing small animals apart, and we don't know you. Or you'll wish we didn't know you. There is no need to be insulting. I'm just trying to be clear. If you break any civil law, you're in very grave danger, and not from the KGB. We in the FBI have our own processes and resources to protect, and the last thing we need is publicity about them. Is that clear? Don't worry. Even if I was not afraid of you, I would be afraid of my own people. You'd best be afraid of us as well. There was a knock at the door. Eric, come in. A bespectacled apparition about 7 feet tall and weighing half as much as me pushed open the door and slipped in. He had a manila envelope in one hand and a regular business envelope in the other. Shilkoff, he said softly. I am Shilkoff. Not anymore. He walked across the floor with no sound. He handed Shilkoff the manila envelope, and when he grasped it, the dry crumpling noise was loud. I don't want to repeat myself, so listen carefully. You are Harold Samuelson. Harold Samuelson. Your New England accent is much more pronounced than the residue of Slavic. So your documents say you came from Boston. You were born and raised there. We're dropping you in Indianapolis. You have 2 years of college and have most recently worked as a truck driver, chauffeur, and taxi driver. All in New England. You will seek employment as a taxi driver once you know your way around Indianapolis. Your Boston references in that regard are safe. He looked at me. Mr. Bailey will cover them for you. That's all in here? Yes, papers and cards. All of the cards in that envelope are what we call flash, alias documentation. Flash, alias documentation. That means they're only good for identification. There are 2 MasterCards and a Visa in there, and 2 gasoline cards. Don't try to use them. If you charge anything on them, we will come kill you. All right. That was a joke, but don't use them. In this envelope, he handed over the small one, holding it by the corner, there are 2 cards that are backstopped, as we say. The Visa card has a prepaid credit line of $3,000. Once you have used that, you're on your own. The Gulf card is overpaid by $200 and registered to your Indianapolis address. It would be smart to use these to get more plastic in your own name. I know. Americans swim in a sea of credit. Yes, and you are an American. If you forget that, you may die. He stared at Shilkoff, as still as a stalking bird. That is not a joke. Shilkoff stared back. I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy, he chanted in a monotone. Yankee Doodle do or die. A real live nephew of my Uncle Sam, born on the 4th of July. Very good. He looked at Luzner. May I go? She nodded, and he slipped out, looking carefully neutral. Luzner opened a drawer and took out 2 fat letter-sized envelopes. This is your walking around money for Indianapolis. $20,000 in 50s and 20s in each. You get one when we catch Foley. The other you can earn today. I'm at your service. From the same drawer, she produced a yellow pad and a mechanical pencil. Standing, she pushed them over toward him. Names. All those names you claim to have. Name. Function, location, cover. Addresses would be nice. He picked up the pencil and clicked it a few times. with 40 names, that's only $500 per name. Surely I'm saving you.
We're saving your life. Any more complaints, and I'll just send you downstairs to the torture chamber.
Come now. You don't. We built it just for you.
Yes, of course. He picked up the pad. Is there a room where I can be alone?
She nodded and stood up.
Follow me.
They walked out, and Stratton and I sat in silence for a few seconds.
I don't like this at all, I said. We shouldn't give that man anything but the electric chair.
Not to worry, Stratton said. Harriet will fill you in.
What is it?
He chuckled. It's Harriet's game. It's sweet. She'll want to tell you herself.
Leusner came back in, looking satisfied.
So what is it, I said.
That guy Eric.
She sat down and spun around in her chair. We've known for 3 years that he was working for the KGB, feeding him stuff that's neutral or false, sometimes important stuff that's true. When we know it was compromised by someone else, or it's about to go public.
The timing is great. He really has outlived his usefulness.
We know from another double agent that the KGB has tumbled to the pattern. So the last thing he does will be a favor to both of his employers.
Finger that bastard.
So we'd better find out all we can before he goes to Indianapolis.
That's right, she said, smiling broadly. Cab drivers have accidents.
Chapter 31. Valerie. It would be good to visit Leningrad when I didn't have so much to worry about. They had put together a sort of wives' tour, with an unrelentingly cheerful in-tourist woman and a kamikaze bus driver. So we learned all about the Aurora and the October Revolution and the Summer Palace, and we saw the mammoth in the deep freeze and tried to absorb all the art in the Hermitage in 3 hours. Paintings flickering by like the frames of a Saturday morning cartoon. It's hitting Nick hard. Not the tension of the upcoming confrontation. He lives for that kind of stress, though he'd never admit it. It's this country or this city, his childhood memories. Well, 900 days of absolute terror and deprivation. After almost 90 days of it myself, I had some inkling of how they feel. Everyone you meet over 50 seems to radiate memories, the permanent existential bruise of having survived the war. Everyone under 30 radiates impatience. Sometimes it feels like the whole country is a monument to the great patriotic war, and the old men in charge use it as a guilt trip on the young. Waiting in line at the cafeteria, I met a woman who was studying English at the university, who was bitterly sarcastic, whispering about the new war memorial being constructed out in the suburbs. She and her boyfriend had been trying to get an apartment for 3 years, so that they could get married and not have to live with parents. But no, there had to be another granite slab of socialist realism in the middle of dignified acres that should be holding up apartment buildings. It's like a person who survived having a cancer cut out and keeps the damned thing in a jar, showing it constantly to his children and neighbors. Don't smoke. Eat lots of fiber. This could happen to you. And yet you can't criticize it, not from the outside, no more than you can tell a widow to stop grieving. We went to the Piskaryevsky Cemetery on the outskirts of the city, where most of the people who died in the siege are buried. Symbolic gravestones and marble plaques on the ground, not identifying individuals. No one knows how many lie there. More than 1 million. Acres of rolling fields with carefully spaced trees. A memorial building full of terrible photographs. Piles of bodies, buildings exploding, fires and ice. A crying woman pulling a child's sled with the child lying on top, rigid in death. When we left, it was raining and the sky was almost black. Back at the hotel, Nick was sitting at the window, staring out over the Neva. He asked me where I'd been, and I told him, and he burst into tears. Silent tears. He tried to laugh it off through the tears, saying he'd had too much vodka with lunch, and the sadness of the city was getting to him. Maybe that was for the benefit of the microphones. Maybe it was for me. But he should know that after 25 years, a woman can tell when her man has had a drink.
Something is gnawing away at him, and we can't talk about it. Not just because of microphones. Chapter 32. Nick. I had tested the watch against President Fitzpatrick when we were alone, carefully, asking him direct questions that would normally generate indirect answers, and it had worked. It also worked well with the translator, Menyenkov, and his two KGB men. Today I would find out whether Vardanyan was hard of hearing. We were taking over the Swank Petrovsky restaurant on the 10th floor of the hotel, all of the apparatchiki from both countries who had to make their importance known by bending elbows with the most powerful. Premier Dr. Vardanyan would be there, since he happened to be in the neighborhood on his way back from meeting Fitzpatrick for their symbolic reunion in Germany. Fitzpatrick couldn't make it, of course, but Vice President Aldrich appeared as if by magic. I was beginning to recognize in myself an unreasoning prejudice against people in rumpled dark suits with thin black ties and smirks. They were much in evidence. There was always one in the elevator, always one in the men's room, always in the bar, in the lobby, in the tea room. Somebody hand me the raid. When the vice president and his entourage showed up, I was waiting in the lobby as requested. I was to be his translator. It was surprisingly easy to get him alone. His Secret Service guard had to go upstairs to report to someone. You could tell that Aldrich was miffed at that. I could have been a dangerous spy. It was easy to test the watch on Aldrich because he was a smoker. With smokers, I'd just say, give me a cigarette. Not, please, do you have? And when they held it out, I'd say, no, take it back. If they did both without reaction, I could be pretty sure the watch was working. If they did react, I could cover myself by saying, sorry, I'm trying to quit. Not quite myself. Aldrich handed me a cigarette out of a tool leather case and put it back without comment. Who's minding the store, I said. You here and the president in France. Spain. Actually, Fitz is still running things. Wonders of modern science. Briefing by satellite every morning. Cabinet meeting before dinner. All unclassified, of course. Walls have ears. After lunch, he usually gets in touch with me and Seals. Peter Seals was the press secretary. That he called the president Fitz was revealing. That was his political nickname. I found out with the watch. His friends called him Gid. Valerie was waiting for us at the head table, along with Menyenkov and a few special assistants for this and that, American and Russian. I introduced her, my Linda, and Menyenkov, and we joined everybody else in waiting for Vardanyan. A formal Russian dinner is more fun than an American one, though to appreciate it fully requires more tolerance for alcohol than I have. A long trough set in the center of the table was filled with shaved ice, cooling three different kinds of vodka, two varieties of Soviet champagne, and incongruously, many long-neck bottles of Pepsi-Cola, legacy of Arm & Hammer. Most of the Russians were drinking Pepsi, and most of the Americans champagne. Menyenkov greeted me warmly and poured me a glass of champagne. I'm afraid it's not Mums, Anson. I know. I took a small sip, sort of like carbonated Thunderbird. When do you expect Vardanyan? He spread his hands. His plane came in 3 hours ago. I knew that, of course. He may be resting. What if he rests till midnight? Hunger is the best sauce, he said in French. I couldn't remember whether I, as Anson Rafferty, spoke that language. I smiled noncommittally. In America, the guest of honor usually shows up late, Aldrich said. Is it that way here? Sometimes, Menyenkov said softly, comically slewing his eyes from left to right. Sometimes he doesn't show up at all. I laughed, and so did Aldrich uncomfortably. Your friend Ivanov is conspicuous by his absence. The Ukrainian KGB man. Only so much room at the table. He poured himself some more champagne. I assure you he is here in spirit, so to speak. I raised my glass to him. As some of my friends must be. What was that? Aldrich asked. Old Russian toast, I said. Absent friends. A festive Russian meal would normally be many hours of eating and drinking. You start out with what would be considered appetizers in other countries' culinary traditions. Bits of smoked fish, small boiled potatoes and sour cream, pickled vegetables, caviar rolled in small pancakes. And you follow each tidbit with a shot of ice-cold vodka. The vodka's less than 70 proof, but a lot of it goes down in the course of a couple of hours nibbling. Then the main course comes out, perhaps a stroganoff or baked stuffed fish or fowl, along with wine. Then a sweet and brandy. Then more brandy and whatever vodka's left. Then you try to remember whose flat you're in and what your own name is, just in case. Our banquet was going to be more Western style, but they did bring out token plates of traditional appetizers. Menyenkov was demonstrating to me the correct way to roll up caviar in a pancake when everyone got to their feet. Coming through the door, Vardanyan told everyone to sit and strode toward our table, trailing a quartet of bodyguards. He greeted Menyenkov by his first name and shook hands with the vice president, speaking rapid-fire Russian. "The premier welcomes you," Menyenkov translated, "and thanks you for having been able to grace us with your presence on such short notice." Vardanyan had taken 3 years of English in school, according to the CIA, but didn't speak it well. There had been periods in his life when it wouldn't have been safe to speak English well. For a long second he studied me, focusing the considerable force of his personality. He was a small man with features invariably described as hawk-like. Sharp, beak nose, sloping forehead with a sharply defined ridge of bone under eyebrows that looked like stiff filaments of white wire curling. He was almost completely bald. His skin was wrinkled and spotted with age and work, but his eyes were cool, clear gray. I translated Aldrich's polite response, and he nodded, looking abstracted for a moment. Then he turned his attention back to me. "They tell me you used to work for the CIA. "Yes, in Germany, back in 1962, and do you work for them now?" "No, nor any other intelligence agency. Unless you count the KGB, technically." "And you are independently wealthy?" "My wife is." He smiled, almost wan. "Then can you tell me why you took General Lambert's job?" "He was sick, he asked me. Also, I have never been to Russia." I turned on the watch. This had to be done delicately, with all these people listening who knew Vardanyan more or less well. "What's the premier talking about?" Aldrich asked, breaking my concentration. "Small talk, sir. He's asking about my qualifications." Menyenkov whispered a translation to Vardanyan.
"Yes. Qualifications," Vardanyan said, putting the tips of his fingers together. "I find it remarkable that the president would choose an ex-CIA man, however skilled an interpreter he might be." "I never was a CIA man, actually. I was a private citizen working in Germany, and the State Department asked me to dig up some information. I only later found out that the CIA was involved." By pushing my wrist along the tablecloth a few inches, I could turn the gain all the way up. "I assure you that you can trust me completely. I'm a good American, but not political. My primary allegiance is to mankind in general. You must believe this if we are to work well together." He rubbed one finger up and down his long nose, staring. "For some reason, I do trust you. You are a most persuasive man." I turned the gain down. It might be suspicious if everybody at the long table went along with what anybody else said. Vardanyan spilled some caviar on a pancake and rolled it up one-handed, John Wayne style. He smiled at Aldrich and said, "Now to the serious business of eating," with an accent as thick as the Neva outside. Chapter 33, Jacob. We had to go into Washington to find a store that carried Shilkoff's vile French cigarettes. He was going to have a hell of a time getting them in Indianapolis. Maybe he'd live long enough to kick the habit.
We had him sequestered under discreet but heavily armed guard in a condo in Vienna, Virginia. The agency owned the top three floors. The doorman and the elevator operator were GS8 muscle. In 2 days, we rounded up more than 40 of the agents he'd named. I was dying to interrogate him about Foley, but Leusner asked us to hold off. She had to go to Berlin for a series of meetings and wanted us to wait so that she could be in on it. I think she also wanted at least some of the leads not to pan out, to give us some leverage on him. So for most of a week, Jefferson and I sat in the room next to his and read, watched television, played cards for matches. Each match was worth $1 million, and Jefferson won not quite enough to pay off the national debt. We shouldn't have been wasting time, though. Shilkoff didn't know where Foley was, or rather, he guessed right. And it was no place obvious, except now, in retrospect. 4 days. What would the world be like now if we'd traced him down and stopped him? Leusner went straight from the plane to Langley, and straight from Langley to the Vienna condo, and walked in unannounced on our game of million-dollar whist. Her face was puffy with jet lag. She was holding the envelope of walking around money, the bribe. She slapped a heavy envelope against her palm twice, smiling wearily. Shall we? We tossed down the cards and Jefferson put on his coat. Ironically, Shilkov was watching The Price is Right, perhaps in the spirit of trying to understand his newly adopted country. He was engrossed and looked up, startled, when we came in through the connecting door. Leusner turned off the television and sat stiffly on the edge of an easy chair. Most of the leads you gave us have been successful. She took a slip of paper out of her breast pocket and glanced at it. Except two here in Washington. Can you tell us anything more about James Edward Wentworth or Suzanne Lynn?
You didn't find them?
No. Wentworth flew the coop. His apartment's clean. Lynn went out to a movie and never came back.
He shrugged. Washington's a small town. When you started picking people up, the word must have spread.
I suppose. Have you found a lookalike?
None exact, of course. I narrowed it down to three.
We'd given him some photo albums the FBI supplied. They weren't criminals, just people with various facial characteristics, photographed from the front and side. Shilkoff had male Caucasian blonde, 50 to 60, male Caucasian white, 50 to 60, and male Caucasian bald, 50 to 60. All three were in the blonde volume. Jefferson and I had seen them 2 days before. She looked at the nondescript pictures and shrugged.
Okay, so where is he?
He leaned back on the couch and laced his fingers together.
I thought that you would never ask. He is in Russia. Leningrad, or headed there.
We all stiffened.
The summit, Leusner said, that was the next day.
You could have told us earlier, I said. Shilkoff smiled sweetly.
As I say, you never asked. I think you made a point of not asking.
How do you know he's going to the summit? Leusner said.
The woman, Valerie Foley, she doesn't know she told me anything.
So you didn't force it out of her, Leusner said.
Oh, no, not in the sense of torture. In fact, I never hurt her at all, though I did threaten to. That's part of the technique.
Go on.
We gave her only water for a couple of days. I worked on her resistance with various psychological devices. Finally, we gave her water that contained a hypnotic. When she fell asleep, I injected her with a compound the KGB's special services technicians made up called Batch 7. It lowers one's antagonism toward interrogation.
Like pentothal? I asked.
Somewhat. People don't babble so with it. It's almost like normal conversation.
Makes torture obsolete, Jefferson said. As usual, Shilkoff ignored him. But wait. She wasn't in contact with him until the Cabin John thing, right? Your people in Boston had her.
That's correct.
Then she couldn't know where he was going. She couldn't know about Leningrad.
Ah.
This is where you have to trust my expertise, my knowledge of human nature, especially when it comes to people lying or telling the truth. Go on. I found that she knew nothing more about Foley's power than we did, as I told you a few days ago. But I went a little further and told her what we suspected, that Foley had somehow discovered or invented a technique or substance or device that completely subverted a person's free will, that it would make him do exactly what Foley asked, even kill himself. She said she had suspected that for some time from various questions we had asked, but it wasn't anything she had any knowledge of. He took out a yellow cigarette and tapped it on his thumbnail, inspected the end, and lit it carefully with a wooden match. And so I asked her about herself. What would she have him do with this power? He watched the match burn almost to his fingers, then dropped it in the ashtray. Go to Leningrad, Leusner said. Disrupt the summit? Not exactly. I'm only inferring that. What she said specifically was that he could get into government, wind up next to the president, talk him into making peace. She thought about it some more and said that he wouldn't have to limit it to the president of the United States. He speaks so many languages so well and so forth. She had a high opinion of him. She even mentioned Russian specifically and Vardanyan. I didn't think much of it at the time, since there was obviously no way Foley could get within 10 kilometers of the premier without permission. Later, after Cabin John, I thought about the summit. That's fantastic, I said. He smiled, a baby's plump lips. Consider it. How many people go along with the president? A plane load? 2 plane loads? It's just possible, Leusner said. According to her profile, she was very passionate, even fanatical about peace, and I think he may be, too. That's all over his MIT dossier, I said. He jokes with his students about marrying a hippie, about neither of them ever recovering from the 60s. Worth checking. Jefferson, you get in touch with the Secret Service and get all you can about everybody going to the summit with Fitzpatrick. Better ID all the press, too. I suppose they'll have a separate plane. Use my name freely, but don't tell anybody what you need the information for. Jefferson nodded and headed for the phone in our room. Bailey, you go through state and try to get us diplomatic clearance into Leningrad. We get into the visa red tape and the Soviets will hold us up till Labor Day on principle, if they smell the agency. She stood up and dropped the envelope into Shulkov's lap. If we do find Foley, you're free to go. Eric Langer, the quiet, tall fellow from our technical services section, will bring your tickets and instructions. Shulkov started to say something, but she turned away abruptly. I'm bushed. Is there an unoccupied bed around here? Sure, follow me. I led her into the bedroom. Jefferson's bed was made up with military precision. You could bounce a quarter off it. I was obscurely gratified that she chose my rumpled one. Chapter 34, Nick. It gave me an odd feeling to be in a room with 6 KGB men and 6 of their American counterparts, CIA and Secret Service. It was the room where the confidential part of the summit talks would be held. All 12 were presumably electronic entomologists. Menyenkov and I had been invited to watch the proceedings as non-technical witnesses. He seemed amused but alert. The Russians had proposed a fine old 19th-century drawing room in the private part of the Hermitage, which the Americans instantly vetoed. Full of nooks and crannies and doubtless already wired for sound with fifth-generation Japanese smart bugs. The Americans suggested an unornamented Finnish modern meeting room at the Leningrad, overlooking the Neva. But the Russians said no windows. They said the Americans could bounce a laser off the glass from orbit, pick up the speech vibrations. The CIA men laughed and said they wished they could. I would have assumed that particular trick to be physically impossible if they hadn't laughed. The two teams finally reached uneasy agreement, settling on a modest interior meeting room in the Leningrad. All the rooms on its floor and the floors above and below were emptied, mutually inspected and sealed off, which meant that half of our protocol team was sent grumbling to the Metropole downtown. They wouldn't have to stay there long, though. This was April 29th. The back streets of Leningrad were filling up with provincial marching bands practicing, athletic teams going through routines, and elaborate floats decorated in themes of Mir, which in Russian means both peace and world. If things go well with Vardanyan and Fitzpatrick tomorrow, they'll have something to Mir about. I took a nap after the debugging session, knowing that Fitzpatrick would be coming in around 7. The dream came back again, I think. Nothing like this has ever happened to me. I appear to be having the same dream, or a dream about the same things, every time I get into REM sleep. And then I strongly suppress the dream upon awakening, or before. It must be a memory of Leningrad. But a bloody arm? I would remember it if it were significant. There are 100 memories from that time I would suppress if I could. Plenty of disembodied arms and legs, sometimes heads, sometimes worse. I learned what the female genitalia look like from the immodesties of 2 frozen, shattered bodies entwined. That is a memory that comes back unwanted. The cliché truism that people who gravitate toward the study of psychology do so because they are profoundly hurt in their own minds. I know from observing my colleagues that there is more than a grain of truth in that. And of course, they know it from observing me. What if they found out I was a murderer, a spy, and a megalomaniac out to change the world? Some would shrug and say, "What did I tell you?" I was with the party that met the president at the airport, but we only exchanged a cursory greeting as I introduced Menyenkov. He then drove to the hotel with a limo full of advisors, having no need for a translator. I went back with Menyenkov. We drove for a while in companionable silence. "It is frustrating," Menyenkov said. "When I began training for this job, as a child, really, just after the war, many people were saying that the United States was going to emerge a huge and powerful empire. Having suffered no damage in the war, having all of its industrial capability intact." And that's about what happened. "Well, it's not empire the way I mean. Some of our people do talk about the American empire, meaning your country plus all the client states embraced by NATO, CETO, ANZNAT, the OAS. Not the most loyal clients." "I know. That's what I mean. The American hegemony that we were going to face, it's not really there. It's as if you took aim at a target, and as it drew near, it broke up into many targets of various sizes. Still one largest piece, but the others can't be ignored." He laughed. "I should not indulge in metaphor in a foreign language. I don't mean shooting at you." "I think I understand. But should you be saying this to an ex-CIA agent?" "You're right. It hardly seems fair, since I have myself never had anything to do with the KGB. We both laughed. "What I mean is that, in a curious way, it would be easier for us to negotiate if it had come about that way. America is a monolithic power with no complicating alliances." "Some country has a proverb saying you should choose your enemy well because you're fated to become him. Is that Russian?" "Probably. I could never keep them all straight." He tapped on the steering wheel with a ring. "That can be taken 2 ways. Do you want to become like us?" "I don't know Russia well enough to say," I said, and the truth startled me. "Perhaps we can compromise and each wind up with the best of both worlds. No McDonald's." "Okay, and no so-called champagne." We laughed together. I turned on the watch at its highest setting. "Can I see Vardanyan tonight, with you along and nobody else?" "That shouldn't be any problem." "Can we set it up so that it's in a safe room, where we won't be overheard?" "I can't speak for the CIA, No KGB will be listening.
You are a KGB officer yourself.
Of course.
What rank?
Major General. I am the highest-ranking KGB officer in Leningrad, currently, I believe.
Wonderful. You will arrange this meeting tonight under some reasonable pretext.
Then come get me.
All right.
You will follow these orders, but forget that I gave them to you. You will not recall any of this conversation since I said, "Can I see Vardanyan tonight?"
All right.
I turned off the watch.
Looks like rain.
He peered up through the top of the windshield.
We should just make it.
Chapter 35, Jacob. There was no way the State Department could officially get us to Russia the day before May Day, short of stuffing us into a diplomatic pouch. But the CIA does have resources. A Lions Club tour group was delayed by engine trouble in Los Angeles long enough for me to fly to Seattle and intercept them, bearing passport and visa that had been routinely processed, just in case. I was a Lion from Marlow, Oklahoma. I hoped nobody would question me about that. Do they still have cowboys and Indians down there? Are they rich with oil money? I'd have to make up answers. By way of cover, they gave me a handful of Southwest Equity Insurance Company business cards and a fake leather traveling presentation kit. If anybody got too curious, I would start selling him a policy. There was no trouble from my fellow passengers, though. The airline had provided free drinks during the delay in Los Angeles, and there had been a party. When the plane picked up our small contingent at SeaTac Airport at midnight, only the crew were conscious. When the Lions woke up the next day, flying over the Arctic, they were subdued. There was an in-flight movie where the main character was a car. During it, I memorized large parts of Fodor's Russia, especially the street map of Leningrad, since I would have to break away from the tour group and rendezvous with Harriet. Actually, we should have wound up in the same hotel. We spent a couple of hours in Helsinki, waiting in lines, and then there was a short flight to Leningrad, and the fun began. 6 lines through passports. I chose the shortest one, which turned out to be the longest. After an hour, I finally got to the glass booth. A 19-year-old KGB private said, "Pasbord," and I gave it to him. For a good 2 minutes, he didn't look at it, just stared at me, unsmiling, directly at my face. I assumed he did that with everyone, and returned his stare with a pleasant smile.
"You speak Russian, don't you?"
he said in a sudden, loud, staccato voice, accusing. I tried not to change expression. "I'm sorry, I don't speak Russian."
"You aren't fooling anybody."
I guessed this was also part of his routine. He went through my passport page by page, though it was newly issued, blank, except for the small stamp on the 4th page from Helsinki. Suddenly, he glared up at me.
"Ah."
He pulled a hand mic from the wall.
"Please, Captain. There is an irregularity. Kiosk 4.
He hung the mic back up and redoubled the intensity of his stare. After a minute, the captain showed up. They exchanged whispers while he stared at me from his loftier rank. He also scrutinized my passport and then put it in his shirt pocket. He stepped out of the booth.
"Follow me,"
he said, with an accent good enough for Hollywood.
"Bring your luggage."
We walked away from the luggage inspection tables and down a corridor that smelled of mildew and vinegar.
"In here."
He opened a door.
"Wait."
A table and 2 wooden chairs under a bare hanging light bulb. A toilet and wash basin in a dingy alcove. No windows. The door closed behind me, and he locked it with a key. I leaned against the table and waited uneasily. What could they do to a CIA agent entering Russia illegally? I knew what they could do. They could make me disappear, and the agency wouldn't peep. Wind up working on a hydroelectric project in Katanga until I froze solid, which would be sometime in early June. Or they might try to trade me for a couple of real spies. Interesting thought. I could finger Shilkov for them. All I want is my freedom and a Hero of the Soviet Union medal. After some rattling and muttering, the door creaked open, and the KGB captain returned, followed by a skinny man in a dark suit. "Sit down." I did, and the captain sat across from me. He leafed through the passport and stared at the first two pages. "Who is the mayor of Oklahoma City?" "How should I? Your passport was issued there, was it not?"
"It is the capital of your state."
"But I've only..." "You were born there." To the man in the suit, he said, "He lives outside the biggest city in his state, the city where he was born, but he cannot name the mayor." "My parents moved away from Oklahoma when I was 2, I said rapidly. "I hadn't set foot in the state until I moved back there last year." "He says that..." I understood. "Ask him why he joined the flight in Seattle. Los Angeles is closer to Oklahoma." The captain translated the question. "I have friends there. It didn't cost much extra. What is all this about, anyhow? Do you take one person every hour and give him the third?" "Not at all," said the civilian in thick English. "Show him." He opened the passport to the picture on the second page. "Look at this." He ran his fingernail under one edge, and it came loose. "I have seen many thousands of American passports. All had pictures very firmly glued down." Oh, shit. Super spy. I wouldn't know anything about that. I thought they came that way. I'd never had a passport before. "Yes, of course. But you must see that if this truly was not your passport, it could be the case that..." He paused to retrieve the subordinate clause. "You have taken the original picture off and glued yours on, but without enough glue, or the wrong glue. You see why we are suspicious. Look, though." I grabbed the passport and ran my finger along the embossed stamp that covered both the photograph and part of the page. "How could I fake this? It says Department of State, United States of America. How could I fake that?" "I'm sure there are ways." He looked up at the civilian. "It's probably nothing. You'd better have the forensic people look at the passport, though, and search his luggage very thoroughly and his person." That sounded like hours, not to mention Siberia. "I'm afraid we will have to detain you for a little while," the captain said, putting my passport back into his pocket. "I will send somebody with a cup of coffee and a roll." He stood up. "Hold it." I stood up too. "I'm with a tour group. Are you going to hold all of them up too?" He picked up my suitcase. "Arrangements will be made." After about an hour, my coffee and roll appeared. They looked an awful lot like lukewarm tea and a piece of black bread. Better than nothing. I worried for another hour about being searched, which I was sure would include a colonoscopy with a dime store flashlight. But when it happened, I wasn't even made to undress. An unsmiling lieutenant patted me down in a desultory way and left without a word. I'd first gotten in line at 11. At 4, an in-tourist lady showed up with my luggage and passport, and no apologies. She led me to the money changers, where I got $100 worth of good, soft Russian currency. And then I was given my very own tour bus, evidently the one that had taken the other lions into town earlier. She said our hotel had been taken over by American government people here for the summit, but we were going to have a much nicer hotel in the center of the city, the Astoria, full of history and old-world charm. That was nice, but I was supposed to meet Harriet at the 9th-floor tea room of the Leningrad Hotel at 4, 6, or 8. Maybe I should argue, "Hey, I'm an American government person." No. It was a long drive through cold, gray rain. No Russian road signs, no billboards to break the birch and pine forest monotony. Decades after conjugating my first Slavic verb, I finally get to Russia, and it looks just like upstate Michigan. Chapter 36, Nick. The dream was especially bad last night. I woke up three times, always with the bloody arm fading from memory. In the last two, there was somebody with the arm brandishing a knife. I had hoped to get plenty of sleep for today's challenge. Not to be. But I had a long soak, and Valerie gave me a good rubdown. We talked about where we might be next week, if we don't wind up in custody by this afternoon. Through Menyenkov and Vardanyan, I had made certain arrangements with the Soviet press, and their American and European counterparts knew that something was up. I spent most of the morning strolling from room to room with my watch, making sure the Fourth Estate of the Free World would not be scooped by the likes of Pravda and Izvestia. By noon, everybody knew that something big was coming down, but nobody who was constrained by the truth could claim any details or reliable attributions. I assumed that by the time of the meeting, 2 o'clock, people's imaginations would have taken care of that. The Americans got together at noon in a small banquet room for roast beef sandwiches and potato salad, courtesy of the White House cooks, which seemed strangely exotic after all the caviar and pickled vegetables. Valerie and I were not seated with Fitzpatrick, who was going over last-minute details with his aides. In a few hours, they were going to wonder why he'd withheld his blockbuster. But that was consistent with his personality. He has a liking for grand, dramatic gestures. There was only one small detail to take care of before the meeting. After lunch, there was a punch bowl and a semblance of relaxed mingling. I kept my eye on the Secret Service men, waiting for one to isolate himself. Finally, Jerry Kepperman, the second in command, drifted over to stare out the window. I sidled up next to him and turned on the watch. "Do you have a second, Jerry?"
"Sure, Dr. Rafferty. What's up?"
"I want you to find me a small pistol, something I can stick in my belt or pocket without being obvious."
"No problem. Little revolver in my ankle holster."
He started to reach for it.
"No, not now. In 2 minutes.
I want you to go to the men's room next door. I'll meet you there."
"Okay."
"You won't remember any of this. Nothing I said to you. Just follow directions."
"Okay."
I went straight to the men's room and waited. It was dirty, but not as noisome as most of the Soviet public bathrooms I'd been in, a concession to the hotel's foreign guests. There was nobody there, but I had to assume there were listeners. Kepperman came in, and I motioned him over to the urinal. I flushed it and whispered in his ear, "Go into the first stall and take off the pistol and ankle holster. Leave them on the floor." He nodded and did it. Muted rip of Velcro. When he came back, I flushed again. "You will remember having loaned the pistol to another agent. You'll get it back tonight."
"Okay.
Go back to the luncheon now." He did. I went to the stall. I hoped that if there were hidden cameras or people peeping, they didn't have the insides of the individual toilets covered. If they were being that thorough, I was done for anyhow. Snub-nosed Colt 38 Special. 6 shots. 6 more in a rubber loader taped onto the side of the holster. Not much protection against the Secret Service and KGB collections of Ingrams and Kalashnikovs. But I didn't really plan to shoot it out with anybody. I just wanted an edge. I strapped the pistol onto my ankle and came out of the stall. Still alone. For the 100th time, I looked, and the envelopes were still in my inside coat pocket, untouched. For the 100th time, my fingers found the throwaway plastic glove in the other pocket. There would be no fingerprints. One envelope and its contents were authentic White House stationery, typed upon by a White House secretary. The other, which had been harder to arrange, was heavyweight Russian bond, transcribed from my handwriting by a secretary in the Soviet embassy in Washington. Perhaps we had been careful enough. If we hadn't, well, at least I wasn't unarmed. Menyenkoff and I got there a few minutes before our charges. The room was bare, scrubbed, too clean. There was something in the air that made my eyes hurt.
Are you nervous? He asked.
Da.
You've done things like this before?
Not this scale. I've worked with Dr. Vardanyan in French and Polish, and with some other people in English.
He shook his head slowly and continued in Russian, but nothing really like this. The importance of it makes me a little sick. What if I make a mistake?
He made a helpless fluttering gesture with his hands and switched back to English.
I can't help thinking, this is my children's future, even though the meeting is largely symbolic.
He stood up and walked 3 paces to the wall.
My own life has been more than adequate. I have no complaints. But I have a boy who's just started university, and a girl who is still a girl. It's their future. I worry.
No need to worry. Not about language. We can backstop each other. You know the phrase?
I get the sense of it, yes. If one of us makes a mistake, the other can point it out, and there's no harm.
That's right.
True, and thank you. But I woke up this morning thinking I would much rather read about this in the newspaper than be part of it. Don't you feel that way?
I didn't have to lie.
The door opened, and Vardanyan and Fitzpatrick came in, along with Kepperman and a Russian guard. We stood for the leaders. The guards waited until they both sat down, and then backed out to rejoin the other guards outside. Each of the 4 places at the table had a yellow tablet, pencil, pen, and an agenda typed in both languages. Fitzpatrick picked his up and scanned it.
Most of this is pro forma. It's only the last 3 we really have anything to argue about, right?
I translated.
That's right, Vardanyan said. I still have some reservations about item 6. Trade restrictions on potentially sensitive industrial products. My advisors are uncomfortable with the wording of that. But it's something for specialists to work out. I think we agree on the sense of it.
He smiled thinly. If not the necessity.
Menyenkoff translated. For about an hour, the 2 men sparred politely, mostly over trade relations and human rights.
Long enough.
I took a deep breath. I turned on the watch at its highest setting, put on the plastic glove, and took out the 2 envelopes. Vardanyan was starting to speak.
Excuse me, I broke in. I'm in charge now.
The 2 Russians nodded.
What's up? Fitzpatrick said.
Just a minute.
I handed Vardanyan his envelope. Please read this very carefully.
What's the glove for?
Fingerprints.
I handed Fitzpatrick his envelope. Read this carefully. You're about to deliver it as a speech to a couple of billion people.
Fitzpatrick didn't take the envelope. He just looked at me.
What the blazing hell are you talking about?
I'd never actually had my blood run cold before. It's an accurate expression. Fitzpatrick started to rise, half turned toward the door. I dragged the .38 out and cocked it.
Don't. If you call out, I'll kill you.
He sat down slowly and looked at Vardanyan and Menyenkoff. Vardanyan was reading, and Menyenkoff was watching the scene with detached interest.
So, what's the matter with them? It's as if...
Oh, no. He covered his eyes with a large hand.
You're the guy the CIA's after. Foley. How the hell could you get into this room?
That's not important.
You must have had control over me back in Washington. Why doesn't it work here? Hearing. That's it.
God, would he have to die for deducing that?
What do you mean? ear infection. Then the damned pressurization in Air Force One. I've got tinnitus real bad. Loud buzzing sounds and ringing. It must interfere with whatever you do.
I motioned with the gun. Read the speech. He picked it up.
I'll read it out of curiosity. I won't deliver it for you.
He stared at me.
I don't think you'll kill me. But if you do, you do. I accepted that as a condition of employment years ago.
He read through it carefully and set it down.
Vardanyan has the same?
Yes. I wrote Vardanyan's and my... A person familiar with your style wrote yours. He will deliver his speech even if you don't do yours. That would set up an interesting situation.
I would almost do it just to see what happens. But no. Vardanyan will deliver his and... It will be explained away. He cracked under strain. He's an old man.
We'll see. Keeping the gun trained on him, I went to the door and opened it partway.
Kepperman, would you come in here for a moment?
The big man came in, looking cautious. I told him to close the door behind him.
You're carrying that Ingram, right?
I am.
And guarding Mrs. Fitzpatrick?
That's right.
The president is supposed to give a speech within an hour. If he doesn't, I want you to kill Mrs. Fitzpatrick. And then use the Ingram to kill as many other Americans as you can see.
All right.
Do the same if anything unpleasant happens to me. If I am taken into custody or killed, I mean.
All right. You will forget that I gave you these orders. They will remain in force until I instruct you otherwise. He agreed.
Leave.
That had been a gamble. Fitzpatrick had watched in shocked silence. If he'd started giving conflicting orders, I don't know what would have happened. When the door clicked shut, I suddenly felt faint. I had just arranged for the murder of a dozen or so innocent people. If Fitzpatrick stuck to his principles, or the CIA or Secret Service found me out, or if I had a heart attack, which right now didn't seem too unlikely, I floated back to the table, not really feeling the floor under me.
You're a monster, Fitzpatrick said.
I think I know what I am. Vardanyan was looking at me with a bleak expression, looking just like my stepfather. And as I sat down slowly, the dream rushed in, the first time it had invaded my conscious mind. I was 8 years old and starving, gone beyond hunger to dying, bloated weakness, so cold that my breath glazed into ice on the metal bed frame. And there was a candle in the kitchen, a small wet noise, and I crawled along the cold floor to see and watched for several minutes while my foster father carved a half-frozen bloody human arm into chunks of meat for the pot, a bloody soldier sleeve on the floor with a red star on the shoulder. And we had lamb stew for the next 2 days. And it was good past belief, and nobody questioned where the lamb had come from. Fitzpatrick was talking.
What was that again? I said.
You have to call him back in and cancel that order. Admit your plan has backfired. So far you haven't done any harm. I can guarantee the best of treatment for you.
Oh, I've done harm.
Even if I do give your speech, what makes you think I can implement it?
2 billion witnesses, and the fact that Vardanyan is saying the same thing?
But I know. Sooner or later, the whole world will know where the speeches came from.
I had an answer to that. I was trying to shake off the nightmare image, the memory of the taste.
I can answer that.
The unspeakable guilt of cannibalism, repressed, was that behind everything?
Sooner or later, your hearing will recover. When that happens, I can change your recall of these events. Meanwhile, I'll stay very close to you.
How close do you think you can stay? For how long?
Inspiration.
Dr. Vardanyan is going to invite you to his dacha to the south of here for a few days' rest. You don't want to fly for a while, after all, because of your ear infection. Of course, most of your entourage will stay with you, including me and Mr. Kepperman. You have it all figured out, don't you? Except for a few details. Like what to do with the memory of the taste. Chapter 37. Jacob. Fodor's had warned me about how beautiful Leningrad was going to be. I'll have to go back someday when I have the peace and clarity of mind to appreciate it. They say it reminds people of Amsterdam. So Amsterdam must be full of potholes and noisy construction, and yes, stately symmetry and impressive public parks and monuments. Nice bridges. But I spent a lot of time looking at my watch. The bus driver parked in front of the Astoria and left the engine running, putting a much-handled cardboard sign on the dashboard. Knowing I spoke no Russian, he herded me into the hotel lobby and waited in line with me until he could get a clerk's attention. He told the clerk that I was with the earlier group of American Tigers or whatever, and then stomped out the door to retrieve his bus. In carefully weird English, the clerk explained what I was to do. I was sharing room 364 with so-and-so, but they were all out on a tour. I could leave my bag in the room, and then I would be free to do whatever I wished, so long as I left my passport with him and my key with the floor lady. Better than I'd expected. In 5 minutes, I was back on the street. There were four cabs waiting in front of the hotel. I got in the first and asked for the Hotel Leningrad, speaking no Russian. I probably got a special non-Russian rate, since it was a short ride for $20, but I didn't think it would be smart to argue with him. The lobby was full of American and Russian security types. An American turned toward me. I took a chance and gestured imperiously, beckoning him to a quiet corner. I wished I'd had some of Jefferson's physical presence and chutzpah. I did my best, though. I don't have time to discuss this much. I'm a CIA man, and I'm supposed to make a contact here, an American woman. You want to help me? You have any ID? Come on. Well, look, things have been really complicated since they cut the meeting short. I've got to cut it short? Yeah. Vardanyan left. Some press thing coming up. Look, you can take the elevator there up to anything past the 7th floor, and nobody will bother you. Below that, above here, you need credentials. I've got to get my men together. He turned and went back to his group. That was all right. When the elevator came, it had the buttons for 2 through 6 removed and a couple of armed guards, just in case you'd brought your own button. I pushed 9 and tried to whistle. My mouth was too dry. I asked the guards which way the tea room was. The American shrugged, and the Russian stood impassive, but pointed to the left when the door opened. It was more than an hour after our designated time, but Harriet Lusner was there, sitting alone at a table for 2, seemingly engrossed in a paperback book. She saw me and waved. Jake, I thought you'd never come. Here's your book. She handed me a paperback that was slightly open at the last blank page. There was writing on it. I don't know what the hell is going on here, and I don't think anybody really does. Vardanyan's headed for the Summer Palace for a TV announcement before 6. Fitzpatrick's going to do the same thing here. You go catch V's speech, and I'll wait here. No sign of anyone who looks like F. Keep your eyes open. I scanned it fast. Fine. Look, I gotta run. Catch you here this evening? Yes, in a couple of hours. Go on. I got back in the same cab, since he had gone to the back of the short line in front of the hotel. He took me back across the river and dropped me at the large crowd that was forming where Vardanyan was to speak. I pretended naivete and told the driver I was running out of rubles. How much would that be in dollars? A thoroughly illegal transaction, but it saved me $15. I dove into the crowd and started working my way toward the front, looking for a blonde, portly, middle-aged American. Chapter 38. Nick. I ushered Vardanyan and Menyankov out and told the press liaison woman that Fitzpatrick would be resting for a half hour before he delivered his statement, and that he might or might not talk to the press after that. I used the watch on White House Chief of Staff Froelich to make sure no one on his own team would bother Fitzpatrick. Then I went back in and sat with him, giving Vardanyan time to get to his press site across the river. "I suppose you do mean well," he said, "but I don't think you're aware of the potential for disaster in this speech." "Why don't you outline it for me?" "I can't give you an education in geopolitical realities in the space of 30 minutes. "You don't have to. I've already spent 30 years thinking about it. Peace and war, and what could be done. And spare me the old soldier bit. I was in the war, too, and hurt a great deal worse than you were." "You can't be old enough." I grabbed a pinch of the firm skin under my chin and wiggled it. "Plastic surgery. They can work wonders. That's why, yeah, I haven't been myself lately." He argued with me for about 15 minutes, appealing variously to common sense and patriotism and arithmetic. Then he fell silent and read the speech through a few times. When he delivered it, he actually made some improvements. This is what he said. "I am aware of having some few shortcomings, and one that doesn't normally bother me much is a lack of oratory ability. I think the shorter the speech, the better, and don't have much patience for politicians who go on and on just because they have the floor. But this is one occasion where I could wish that I had the gift of eloquence. Nothing I will ever do or say as President of the United States of America can be as important as what I am going to say to you now. Forgive me for saying it plainly. Everybody knows that the large and fairly equal nuclear stockpiles held by the United States and the Soviet Union have been for half a century rather a mixed curse, paradoxically threatening the survival of the entire world while apparently preventing a catastrophic world war from starting. The key phrases our politicians have traditionally used to describe this curious situation are the frightening ones, the balance of terror, and mutually assured destruction. It's also well known that these stockpiles are, and have been ever since the 60s, much larger than they would need to be if their function were simply military. Grotesquely large. Both the Soviet Union and the United States possess more than 100 times the megatonnage required to obliterate the other's civilization totally. It's hard to imagine. More than 100 times. Most of the presidents and premiers, from Truman and Khrushchev to Dr. Vardanyan and myself, have agreed that these weapons must never be used and pledged that we would not initiate the use of them. Pessimists, in their turn, from the 1950s to the present day, have pointed out that this may be fine for the next week or year, or 10 years, or 1,000. But sooner or later, there will be a man or woman in charge who will suffer a lapse of judgment, a lapse of sanity, and actually use the weapons. That will be the end of civilization, or at least all that we hold civilized. Perhaps, some of our scientists warn, it would be the end of all life on this planet. The problem with idealistic solutions to this situation, where we simply wave a magic wand and all the bombs go away, is twofold. One, as I said, the bombs, with their threat of apocalypse, have brought comparative peace to the second half of this century. Two, the United States and the Soviet Union are not the only ones with bombs. Dr. Vardanyan and I were both soldiers in the last World War. What we hope will forever remain the last World War. No one who lived through that catastrophe could take lightly the obligation of preventing his children and their children from having to relive it. And if it takes the fear of nuclear Armageddon to keep buried in history the specter of whole continents turned into battlefields, of whole generations of men decimated and decimated again, then that fear does serve a noble purpose. If Dr. Vardanyan and I could wave some magic wand and rid the world forever of nuclear weapons, well, I won't say we wouldn't do it. But we certainly wouldn't do it in ignorance of the possible dire consequences. What we have agreed upon is a mutual bilateral reduction in the size of our strategic nuclear forces. A drastic reduction, conducted simultaneously under the supervision of observers from countries aligned with neither the United States nor the Soviet Union. The third largest nuclear power in the world is Great Britain, with 298 warheads capable of delivering 99 megatons of destruction. That is the level to which Dr. Vardanyan and I have agreed to reduce our forces, nearly 1,000-fold. By May Day of next year, both the United States and the Soviet Union will control only 298 warheads apiece, yielding a total of no more than 99 megatons. The distribution of these weapons as to size and type will be worked out according to the defense requirements of each country, but the total number and total yield will be the same. Both countries will undergo continual inspection by neutral observers. In agreeing to this, Dr. Vardanyan has, of course, departed drastically from the policies of all his predecessors, and the world owes him a vote of heartfelt thanks. The disarmament process need not be frozen at this level. If Great Britain wishes to reduce its nuclear forces below their present capabilities, and if they will do so under the same conditions of supervision and inspection that Dr. Vardanyan and I have agreed to, then the United States and the Soviet Union will also reduce to maintain parity. If the British consequently fall below the strength of the fourth nuclear power, which is currently France, with 202 warheads, yielding 92 megatons, then France will be responsible for setting the benchmark. Then China, then India, and so on down the line. It isn't a perfect solution. There is no perfect solution. A lot of voices will be raised, and some heads will doubtless roll, in the process of turning this, our mutual pledge, into diplomatic and legal language satisfactory to all concerned. But the principle is clear, and we will not back away from it. At this moment, Dr. Vardanyan is delivering a speech to the Supreme Soviet in Moscow via a public television link from the Summer Palace here in Leningrad, outlining our agreement. Journalists are present from all over the world, and the message is being broadcast live on every Soviet television channel. We want to give the world some breathing space. The principle we've set down here will certainly be elaborated and refined by leaders of our countries, of all countries, in the future. What we have tried to do is to ensure that there will be a future. They'd set a rostrum up right in front of the meeting room door. I stayed in the room with the door open a crack, so I missed seeing the president's face and nuances of gesture. But I could see the expressions on the audience's faces, which was amusing, and Valerie's, which was gratifying. A small room full of hardened Pols and newspeople, with a scattering of Secret Service, KGB, and CIA folks. When he said the words mutual bilateral reduction, a lot of jaws dropped open. When he elaborated on it, some people looked like they were going to faint. At the end of his speech, about half the audience burst into wild applause. The other half clapped politely and belatedly, and looked at each other in wild surmise. Chapter 39. Jacob. Without ceremony, Vardanyan walked up onto a hastily erected podium, into a glare of television lights, to the exact spot where Lenin had stood the day the Soviet Union was created. That was what the man beside me told his companion, at least. I wondered whether Lenin had also spoken from behind bulletproof glass. Vardanyan's speech may not have been more important than Lenin's, but it certainly was more surprising to the audience. Not so surprising to me. So Foley had gotten to him. I wondered whether Fitzpatrick had said the same thing as advertised. There was an American television team on the other side of the square. I meandered over there and eavesdropped. It was true, according to what their opposite numbers at the Leningrad had told them. Foley had flummoxed the two most powerful men in the world into renouncing the main basis of their power. What the Politburo and the Congress would have to say about their agreement was yet to be heard. Maybe Vardanyan was headed for a long rest cure. Maybe Fitzpatrick, too. There were no taxis, but then I guessed there was no need to hurry either. I walked back down the river toward the bridge to the Leningrad, a mile or so. I was passed by groups of people running in both directions. A lot of happy talking and shouting and passing around of bottles. A lot of mir in the air. Even though it was still light, several barrages of fireworks went off over the river. Setups, I suppose, that were supposed to wait until tomorrow. I checked my watch, subtracting 7 hours for Eastern Standard Time. The Today Show and Good Morning America would be on in 20 minutes. Their staffs were probably quite busy. I was tired and wired. I put my last no-doze between two back teeth and crunched down. The overwhelming gall taste always reminded me of undergraduate days. Nobody paid any attention to me as I walked up to the Leningrad Hotel entrance. Security people had formed up in a double line so that the luminaries could make it to their limousines, running the gauntlet of photographers. I overheard something about Fitzpatrick staying on in Russia for a few days. Probably a good idea. Probably a number of his compatriots will suggest that he take up residence permanently. End of side five. To continue, turn the cassette over.